All right, we'll call the Judiciary Committee to order. Today we have with us Senator Wilkowski, Senator Clint Bishop, and myself, Senator Coghill, Chairman. We do have a quorum, but we don't need a quorum today because what we're going to do is we're going to hear from our VPSO people who deal with VPSOs all over Alaska. And we have in the audience, we have two commissioners, just to let you know, Commissioner of Public Safety and Department of Corrections, and we're grateful for that. We're also grateful for the many people who are in the villages day by day. Many of them got family they have to deal with. So I'll predicate the meeting at the presentation, and please take back from this committee and from me especially our deepest gratitude when you go through your contracts with them. And what you're going to do is you're going to lay out, you know, both solutions and problems and solutions. And I think we're glad to see that. So what we have today, we have Richard Peterson, who's the Chief Central Counsel, Tlingit and Haida. You're the chief, right?
President.
President. And Victor Joseph, he's the chief of Tanana Chiefs Conference. And
Jody,
I'm sorry. Yeah, she is VPSO. And I thought I was going to remember the name, and man, it just must be age. Anyway, couldn't be age, right? We are glad that you're here. We're glad that you present, and I'm glad that you have some administration people here to listen as well as some legislators. It will be recorded, so what we have will be able to be shared throughout this legislature. So please, whoever wants to start, Richard or Victor, put yourself on the record, and you have our attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Victor Joseph, Chief Chairman of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. In addition to some of our staff, I'd just like to introduce them. We have Nick Gaska, he's our Deputy General Counsel, and we have Marna Sanford, and she's our Governance Affair. It's really great being here, and I just wanted to also just thank you for this opportunity. It's very important, and it's good meeting the senators, and I'm looking forward to this presentation and some of our discussion.
So, Victor, before you get on, just to welcome Senator Kelly, who is also on the Judiciary Committee. And Senator, just for your information, we were going to bring up the trust bill today, but I think we have some amendments coming. They're not totally drafted, so we're going to pull that off the calendar and just deal with the VPSOs today. Victor, you're back on.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to state and give you a little introduction of Tanana Chiefs. I know many of you know much about us, but I'll just share this for the record. Currently, Tanana Chiefs operates about 200 grants and a total of about $190 million in different programs, primarily health services, which is about 75% of our organization. We employ about 900 employees right now, 921 at last count. 60% of them reside in Fairbanks and the remaining 40% out in our rural area in the interior. That covers about 235,000 square miles. But if we put that in perspective, it's just a little smaller than the state of Texas. Currently, I like saying that, especially in the right venue, it works all the time. But as we look at state operations, we've been running 48 state different grant programs for a total of about $8 million. And so, you know, we've been running these programs fairly successful over the years, and we'll get more into that in just a little bit. And I'll turn this over to Richard for now.
Thank you. Thank you again for this meeting. Richard Peterson, President of Tlingit and Haida. Tlingit and Haida is a federally recognized tribe, so we're slightly different than some of what our regional nonprofits like TCC. We strictly operate tribal programs. We don't administer health or housing. We represent more than 30,000 tribal citizens worldwide. We serve more than our own citizens, however. We serve citizens of other federally recognized tribes that reside in our service area, as well as we serve non-Native folks under a variety of programs. We operate the for the non-native parents or family members of tribal children for child support, TANF, and ICWA. Non-natives who come to tribal court for services when jurisdiction exists, if you would think of divorces, marriages, guardianship of tribal children. Our Vocational Training Resource Center here in Juneau serves many non-natives. We have the only CDL course in Southeast Alaska for your commercial driver's license. And and then we serve Head Start communities in communities around Southeast Alaska, Rural Cap serving some, but we do the majority of them here in Southeast. We run tribal transportation services that support our communities. In many of our communities in Southeast, we're the ones building bus stops, sidewalks, and things that help enhance the transportation needs of our citizens. Our budget is approximately $30 million. We administer over 70 grants. We have three calendar years. We follow fiscal state and the calendar year. So it's quite a bit of jumping around. We have about 245 employees in the region. 200 of those are in Juneau. The rest are VPSO and Head Start and a few satellite TANF locations, Sitka, Ketchikan. So we have 20 departments serving other programs. And we also do government contracting and that have over 600 employees throughout the country. And we were just the successful bidder on a big project out in Kodiak where we have 60 employees.
And maybe, Jody, you want to make an opening statement at all? Yeah, you'll have to move that around. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members, for having us today and listening to our presentation on the VPSO program in rural public safety. Just a brief introduction. Well, I'll introduce myself first. Jody Potts. I am a VPSO. I've been a VPSO since 2009. I was actually the first female VPSO sergeant in the program, and I am now the VPSO coordinator for Tanana Chiefs Conference. And I'm originally from the village of Eagle, and I could still remember the first VPSO that came into our community and what a positive impact that had on our quality of life, safety, and then just my security as a child in the village. I just want to give you a brief introduction on the VPSO program and the history. So the VPSO program was created in the late 70s as a way to address rural crime problems, the loss of life from fires, drownings, and so on and so forth. It was very difficult for the Alaska State Troopers to address the rural crime issues from the centrally located and ran law enforcement agency. The VPSO program was also created to help save the state money, so cost savings 40 plus years ago was definitely a big point in the program, and it still is today. A big part of the way that the VPSO program saves money is with unfunded mandates on the hosting communities, so the tribe or in some situations a city government pays for a lot of the support for a VPSO. And typically, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, a lot of officers were making minimum wage. They used their own personal equipment to do patrols and affect their job. And they also used some of their own money to put gas in their personal equipment in order to do patrols. And part of that was because the communities, specifically tribes, don't receive public safety or law enforcement funding because of Public Law 280. And so what ended up happening is people did this on their own. And and still today, there are a lot of unfunded mandates on our communities, and the regional contractor, Native nonprofits, Clinkin Haida, TCC, BBNA, and others, also put a lot of their own funding to make the VPSO program successful, as it can be under the current restraints. The philosophy for the VPSO program 40 years ago was local hire. As I said, they made minimum wage. They didn't have equipment or weapons, minimal training, which was very little support because of these unfunded mandates. Still today, the legislature funds the VPSO program in way of positions, and just so for the personnel costs of the VPSO program. The training and uniforms are also provided by the state of Alaska. As far as the TCC VPSO program, we, as Victor mentioned, how large TCC is, and I also always use the Texas comparison that we are approximately the same size as the state of Texas. Very huge area. We have 38 rural communities, and at one point we had as many as 15 officers with a roving VPSO based out of Fairbanks that visited the communities, which there still are many, without a VPSO. Today, we have 37 villages with no law enforcement presence. It has been extremely difficult to recruit and retain officers from within our region. And at this point, the thing that we're seeing is we are recruiting and hiring people from outside of our community, outside of our region, to do this job.
Jody, could you restate that number again? How many villages?
37, sir.
37.
Yes. Okay. And so TCC has put a lot of our own funding into recruitment and retention activities, and also things that would benefit the officers' success in the community, such as paying for broadband internet and other things. I think that most definitely, just kind of a blanket statement about the VPSO program, rural Alaska has changed in the last 40 plus years, and the needs today are different than how the program was created and meant for. There are a lot of things that are impacting communities, such as designer drugs that are coming in, polysubstance use, which is creating a very unsafe environment for community members, but also our officers. And additionally, the way that the program is managed isn't having, affecting change in our region. And so there's still a lot of need out there, and we'll go further into that. But thank you.
And Jason, you're going to come and give an opening statement. And I had a couple of things that I'd probably bounce off you right at the beginning, and then we'll go into your presentation.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Jason Wilson. I'm the Public Safety Manager for Clinton County Central Council. And just a real quick brief history for Clinton. We came into the program. I don't really have a whole lot of paperwork from back in the day, but we started with the program as well when it was developed. Roughly around 2006, Clinton had kind of gave back the program to the state as I think there was no funding for an actual coordinator position, so that created hardship with Clinton County Central Council. Roughly in 2009, Sergeant Waldner with Alaska State Troopers had approached Clinton County to see if we were interested in taking the program back, which we were. I was hired in 2009. We had three VPSOs at the time. We're currently now in the communities of Cake, Angoon, Pelican, Saxman, Heidelberg, Thorn Bay, and Kassan, which is seven VPSOs. But recently, I just hired for Cake. We were vacant for roughly about 2 years almost, which is pretty hard. Pelican is still vacant right now. I'll get into those challenges in a second. One of the huge hurdles that we had, Clinton County had it in the beginning, was the indirect rate. The indirect rate was capped at 15%. Something I'm still learning about, but what I did know was at the time I was growing the program, so we had three VPSOs, and we shot up to, I think it was 11, as I was filling my communities. little did I know that that created more burden and hardship on our organization, as our indirect, I think, was roughly around 38% at the time. So you're creating about a 26-27% shortfall on a million-dollar budget. That, you know, that's over $200,000. That's quite a burden to put on an organization. So recruitment and retention. I know you've all heard a great deal about this, but, you know, this is somewhat of a new challenge, in my opinion, for our program. Mm-hmm. I say that in that, at least up until about 2015, I used to have people waiting. I would have three or four people, what we used to call the hopper, kind of waiting for a position to become vacant. So roughly about 2015, things changed. We are now doing everything possible, in my opinion, to do recruitment. We are on websites. We're blasting on the internet. We're on police websites advertising our positions. We've had commercials made for the whole state of Alaska. We're in our villages. I think that we're doing what we can to recruit people, but people are not wanting to be in law enforcement right now. So like I mentioned just a second ago, CAKE has been vacant roughly for 2 years. And I'd love to share a little bit with you in that, what does that mean? I don't know if you could imagine, and I don't know Juno's a larger scale, but really if you could imagine going down to, let's just say, one officer for the community of Juno, or no officers, and imagine how that would be for an extended amount of time. I mean, crime doesn't stop. People don't just stop doing bad things, unfortunately. And in fact, over those 2 years, we lost two young women that were murdered, two 13-year-olds. So I'm very happy that we finally filled the position in CAKE. Our next challenge, and really for the whole program, is housing. And I think probably Southeast is probably the most fortunate out of all the organizations. You know, we have a sister agency in Clinton County Housing Authority that we partner up with. So the communities of CAKE and Angoon, Saxman, and Heidelberg, we've been able to work on finding housing, working with them. So that's been nice. We've also had Saxman went out and went after a grant to provide housing. So they actually built a facility for essential personnel in their community. So we have one of our VPSOs that placed in that duplex. I think a doctor lives on the other side. But really, housing up north is a lot harder. And Jody didn't really speak on a little bit, but I'm sure she's going to get to that. But we still have communities that don't have running water. Don't have public safety buildings, don't have housing. The housing that becomes available, if there's a vacancy in that community and you're trying to fill it, that house is needed to be used. So holding homes open for any extended time is very difficult for the community. Last thing I'll mention is our clicking out of supplementing the program. So I mentioned a minute ago about indirect. That was on a yearly basis from 2009 till 2 years ago. I think 2 years ago, our indirect cap was raised to 30%. So we have not incurred a shortfall over the last 2 years. But up until 2009, we were incurring a shortfall of roughly $200,000 a year.
Jason, could you just explain the indirect cap for those who may not understand that?
I'll do my best. So the state put a cap on the indirect of 15%. So nowhere have we found in our research of what that means. You know, it's not in statute. It's not in regs. So I don't know where the cap came from personally in the research of trying to bring this attention to the legislation 2 years ago. We couldn't find where the cap came from. Sir? Yes.
Sure. Why don't go ahead and Richard speak to that. Mr. Peterson?
So,
sorry, but Mike has to be swapped.
Yeah. No. So Jason mentions this arbitrary 15% cap. So for those of you who may not be familiar with what an indirect rate is, it's essentially if we get a $1 million grant, we negotiate with the U.S. government and decide what it's going to cost for us to operate and to expend those funds. And so right now for Central Council, it's about 32%. And so when it was capped at 15%, we incur a shortfall. We've made an agreement with the U.S. government that that's what it's going to take for us. So we, if we don't have that money, if an agency or a grantor doesn't meet our full indirect rate, it's up to us to come up with the rest of that indirect. So it's out of pocket. So to operate a grant at a loss doesn't make a lot of sense. We had our former COO did a really extraordinary job of explaining the indirect rate to the former commissioner right before Monaghan. And I'm sorry, I forgot his name. But she was able to explain what those shortfalls are, real dollars. It's not some made-up number. These are real negotiated dollars. And so it has a real hurt to your tribe or your tribal nonprofit if we don't get full indirect. And as Jason was referring, nowhere in the state is there a regulation or anything that says that we can't pay full indirect. There's just an arbitrary 15% cap put in. And luckily, we were able to get the Department of Public Safety to get rid of that arbitrary cap and put in a friendlier arbitrary cap. Still arbitrary. So I hope that explanation helps.
Yeah, but and to their defense, I suppose, they're having the same struggle you are, and that is how to pull the both ends against the middle, and it doesn't look like we're able to meet ends. We have not been able to recruit to the level we need, nor have we been able to pay to the level really that is required. So my guess is they're under an arbitrary cap too. So it's just to their defense. But I wanted to hear from you because what we're looking for is partnerships, solutions, and ways to move this thing.
Thanks, sir.
Mr. Chairman, if we can, just before we move in that, we'd like to have one more little presentation, and then I'd be more than happy to answer that question.
Good.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Nick Gaska, and I'm Deputy General Counsel at Tananaunchee's Conference. I wear many hats at Tananaunchee's Conference, and today I'm not here in my attorney capacity, but rather as an advocate for the VPSO program. Last February of 2017, the VPSO grantees met with Commissioner Monaghan to discuss DPS's proposal to make VPSO state employees under the Alaska State Troopers. We voiced the VPSO grantees, I'll call them a caucus, voiced our opposition to this proposal, and Commissioner Monaghan at that time gave us his commitment to work with the VPSO caucus and contractors moving forward before deciding to implement his plans. We took his word for that, and to our knowledge that there hasn't been any progress or movement towards that. But we have found, though, is that some of those ideas started to creep its way into the legislature and various legislators when we're talking to them about the VPSO program over the last legislative session and into this legislative session. Both of those, the proposal, you know, so we want to just come today and say, you know, although there hasn't been a concrete plan, again, we're still hearing these ideas come up about making VPSOs state employees. And those ideas and justifications are also some myths that have been circulating about the VPSO program. So the contractors and the caucus have the same goal with the state of Alaska, and that's to share the common goal of providing public safety in rural Alaska and providing the best public safety that we can. One thing that we don't want to do and that we try to work on is show our support for BPSOs. They do a hard job. They're often alone, and it's not very easy. So whatever support we can show them, we do, and we don't want them to get discouraged even more by the situation. At TCC, we're moving forward with different plans, but those plans aren't moving fast enough, and we're just trying to let them know, look, we support you. These things take time. You know, to be clear and for the record, the caucus does disagree with making VPSO state employees. We think that the best way to improve public safety is working with DPS, and President Peterson and Chief Joseph will get to those details a little bit later in the presentation. One thing about this, the proposal and some of the justifications that are also missed that have come up, you know, our tribes affected by the VPSO, by this proposal, haven't been consulted. So to the extent that this rumor is still circulating, it'd be helpful if, you know, there would be tribal input into this plan to see how they feel about a drastic change in policy from what they know right now. I want to get into some of these proposals, some of the justifications for this proposal, and some of the myths that were circulating. That the first one being that, you know, DPS would have a direct relationship with the tribes, and tribal grantees are the middlemen to DPS. And our response is we don't act as middlemen. We're able to gather feedback. We're able to address trends. And we use our resources to advocate for tribes in a way that the state never could, given our position and relationships with them. We are given authority over the tribes that we represent. They give us authority to act on their behalf. So whenever we tell DPS or any committee member, for that matter, whether it be health or a Bureau of Indian Affairs program, we have permission from our tribes to act on their behalf. You know, and there's nothing now, in whether by agreement, by contract, or it just might be practice, that prohibits DPS from going into communities and saying, how can we help? There's no rule, there's no regulation that they have to come through TCC to meet directly with those communities. In fact, the communities welcome them. They want DPS in their communities. They want to say, hey, look what's going on. This is our conditions. This is what our housing situation is like. This is what our water situation is like. This is what our health and safety situation is like. So DPS is more than welcome to do that. You know, but the reality is they don't have the funds to go into the state to conduct the outreach that we do. Chief Joseph is in communities every single summer, 4 days a week. Leave on Monday, stay overnight, go to another tribe on Tuesday. We're back at it again Thursday and Friday. This happened over the last 3 years, and that's where we're gathering this information. So we're not sitting in Fairbanks making up things about what's going on in our villages. We're actually out there listening. We have community meetings. The other justification for making VPSO state employees would be if it would be easier to facilitate directly with tribes. You know, like we just said, we disagree with that. This idea can be used directly right now with tribes. DPS can facilitate with tribes right now. And the other problem is how would this solve the problem? How would making VPSO state employees solve the problem of facilitating directly with tribes? It wouldn't. So that's the second justification. The third justification for this proposal was better cross-deputization opportunities. And what that means is that VPSOs would have an opportunity to enforce tribal law in addition to state law. And our question is, why can't this be done right now, number one? Number two, we should be focusing on enforcing state law. We should be focusing on enforcing those crimes that are committed against women, that are committed against helpless children, rather than worry about cross-deputization opportunities, which we're all for. Don't get me wrong, we're all for that. However, those serious crimes are the ones that we're trying to address, especially against the most vulnerable in the communities. The fourth justification was making VPSOs would eliminate multiple supervision layers for VPSOs, and it standardizes the program under DPS. Right now, there is a VPSO has a contractor coordinator, supervisor, and then there's other layers, and they also have to follow TCC policy, there's VPSO policy, program policy. But again, we've been working last August 2016, we formed a caucus with the state head DPS office and VPSO state office to address these problems and to address some of these supervision layers and other sorts of, you know, clogs that would make the system not run as smoothly. And so we feel like by open communication and by addressing these issues head on, that we've made progress. So although it can be a problem at times, we're working through that. And it's no reason to move the whole program under a different organization. The fifth proposal, which may be one of the biggest fifth justification, which may be one of the, is it, it's, I don't want to, sexy, for example, is the word I use, is it would generate cost savings. Now, while we understand the state's financial troubles and need to spend limited resources wisely, a budget hasn't been produced to show that DPS, having VPSOs as their employees, would be a cost savings. And we haven't seen that anyways. There's no justification for that budgetary-wise. We haven't seen that. And until a budget is formed and other factors are taken into consideration, such as the cost to purchase an expensive insurance policy versus the cost to self-insure and pay out claims from the state, we don't know if those cost savings are real. The sixth justification used was this addresses liability concerns for both VPSOs and contractors. As you probably know, VPSOs, they're not state employees. They are contractor employees. Organizations like Clinkin and Haida and TCC aren't in the business of providing police forces yet. But there are, and with that duty of providing security, VPSO, public safety services, there's liability risk. And again, last of August of 2016, we've been working with our insurers, with the state insurance brokers who provide this policy, to really understand and get to know what this policy means. So although there are liability concerns, as there are with any single program we run healthcare programs, and I can't think of a bigger liability than healthcare. We're working through those, and we're taking those on, and we're covering the gaps where we think there's gaps. So those are being addressed. And the last justification that you guys may have heard for making VPSO state employees is a resident pipeline to the state. Tribes will have resident pipelines to the state. The rural hub communities right now have resident pipelines to the state and state troopers, yet our people still don't feel safe and are still exposed to violence. And this is a model of central control of over law enforcement just in rural justice areas that has been addressed and studied already, which I'll get to in a second. So the bottom line for the contractors when they're looking at, you know, either justifications for making VPSO state employees or just questions among lawmakers that say, well, why don't they become state employees, make the whole thing easier? You know, whether intentional or not, this will lead to more control over rural law enforcement in rural, predominantly Native communities. And this proposal or these justifications aren't in rural Alaska's best interest. In fact, the Indian Law and Order Commission's November 2013 report was critical of Alaska's strong centralized law enforcement presence in Alaska. And I'll take only a few more minutes and I'll let you guys go, but I want to read a quote that says, "The strongly centralized law enforcement and justice systems of the state of Alaska are of critical concern to the Indian Law and Order Commission. They do not serve local and Native communities adequately, if at all. The Commission believes that devolving authority to Alaska Native communities is essential for addressing local crime. Their governments are best positioned to effective arrest, prosecute, and punish, and they should have the authority to do so, or to work out volunteer agreements with each other and with local governments and the state on mutually beneficial terms. So although steps have been taken by the state and grantees since this report was released, there is no indication, we believe that making BPSO a state employee is a step in the wrong direction. And, there's been a study done. You guys want a study done? There's been a study done. We just have to look at the November 2013 Indian Law and Order Commission report. They dedicated a whole chapter to Alaska. And if this plan is to move forward or it is to gain traction, I would strongly advocate that you guys ask the questions, what did the tribal communities think about this? How have they been consulted? What are their opinions on this? And also include the rural the contractors who run these rural programs to see how it'll affect them and get their ideas. If you have any questions after, so, I can take questions.
So, Nick, I will just say this. I don't know that there's been a proposal in front of that Senate, certainly not in front of this committee, to head in a direction that you have just indicated. And if there was, there would be a panel discussion looking at the multiple sides of the question. For example, you're citing this Indian Law and Order report. What's the actual official name again?
It's the Indian Law and Order Commission. Report, a roadmap to making.
So that they may very well have had some good recommendations, and they may have some good criticisms. But what we have to continue to look at is how do we best provide for all citizens of Alaska, and that is a unique look, right? And we have to look at it probably a little more broadly. But not less dispassionately, I can tell you that. Mm. And so your point's well taken is what I'm saying. But in this particular arena, we have not entertained from the commissioner, and I haven't actually heard him propose that. I've heard the rumor.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, in this building, if you want to hear rumors, just hang around for a while.
Yeah.
So, but your points are well taken that and I think what the words that I would key off on the Indian Justice Commission would be trying to find mutually beneficial solutions, because I think if we don't do that, we're not serving our people well. And so I'd be glad as we move forward, that will be the central theme of how I would focus in on how to get mutually beneficial, because we know the things that are kicking the feet out from under us Alaskans are huge, mm-hmm. And it seems like the smaller the community, the greater the disruption, probably because there's less resources available, right? And I wanted you to bring your best foot forward so that we could have the discussion. But I just wanted to let you rest assured that we had not entertained any specific proposal in this body yet.
That's good to know, because we were hearing rumors and we were hearing this type of talk from other lawmakers that we've been in contact with. So it's good.
Other lawmakers may. But I can tell you there's a lot of proposals that people will, unfortunately, quite often people will have a legal drafter draft up a law for their own personal benefit rather than for the state's benefit. And I'm sorry to say that out loud, but it's a fact. Senator Bishop, you were...
Yeah, I want to be clear. I mean, I was one of those lawmakers. I met with Victor and Marna, and you bring a problem to me, my brain's doing Mach 3 trying to come up with solutions. So... just to have a conversation.
Well, thank you. As a good perspective, I think it's good that you get to bring it before us, though. And so I just wanted to have that rest assured, but the point is well taken.
Thank you.
Victor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate it, the time you took to allow us to do that. It was a concern. And we were hearing it around, and we wanted to make sure that our concerns were expressed during this one opportunity that we've had. I just want to share this. You're talking about what are we doing and to meet the challenges and solutions, and there are several things. And right now in our GTAC meeting that we have, one of our committees is public safety, and that public safety is chaired by our Sergeant Jody. Potts, and she's doing a remarkable job as we're looking at that. But one of the things I believe, and that I believe that you know, is that public safety is a major concern out in our rural areas, and how are we going to be able to meet the needs of our people and make sure that the people that live and reside out in our rural communities are safe and healthy. And that's what we're all wanting to. And up to just recently, you know, it's been quite frustrating to work alongside public safety to try to create change. But in the need for collaboration, one of the things that we are seeing is that shift now in change and that partnership and how do we move forward. That's why I'm really I'm glad that our Public Safety Commissioner Watt Monaghan's here along with this deputy. And I think that's really important so that he can hear our words, because we're not hiding these words from anybody. We didn't want to come here in secret and say, okay, this is what we feel and all this. What we want to do is get to a collaboration to where we can have positive change. And what we want is a successful program. And right now, I think we can all agree that public safety, the VPSO program, isn't the most successful program that it could be. And it could be successful when managed appropriately. And unfortunately, not all of our tribes believe the VPSO program is working effectively and efficiently either, because things are happening out there and nobody's able to address it. But they're just not thinking it about the VPSO program. They're thinking about it about the state troopers as well, because of the lack of their ability to respond. Now, when we look at recruitment and retention issues, those recruitment and retention issues are very real, not just for law enforcement here in Alaska, but law enforcement nationally. Right. But it streamlines, and we've seen even where the Anchorage City Police are able to look at their recruitment and retention process and make some changes and are now becoming somewhat successful in recruiting, even probably, in fact, taking away some of the state troopers. But the state troopers recently made a change in their policy so that they could improve their recruitment and retention, the same thing that we want to do for our VPSO program. And until recently, it's been kind of stagnant when we were asking for increased wages. Now, if we're looking at the amount we pay a VPSO, that's basically working in a community unarmed by themselves. And pretty much left alone out there to deal with a number of issues. That's 24/7 work. They don't get a break. They don't make enough money to come to town and say, hey, I just need a break when there's been major incidences happening within their communities, or when so many crisis type situations happening that they get stressed. And because there is no venue for them to relieve this, they basically burn out real quickly and vacate the position. What we're looking at is how do we improve this situation, one, in just simple little easy things that we can be doing, low-hanging fruit. And when we're looking at this project or this program, how can we deal with some of the low-hanging fruit, some of the short-term goals? How do we set some mid-range goals, and how do we get to some long-term goals? What the budget committee or the VPSO committee has done now, or public safety committee has done, is they put together a group, and we're all in agreement that we need to start working on this whole process and creating those goals, the short-term, mid-range, and long-term, and what we can do. And even wanting to create a white page on where we should be taking this. I think that's very important, but that also speaks to our partnership, because in that VPSO committee meeting, we have the AG's office, we have DPS in there, we have corrections in there, and a number of tribal leadership that are contractors. And so we have the right people in that room, and then we put subcommittee people at that. Now, that's creating some positive change that I'm liking. It isn't quite there yet because we have a lot to do, but there's things that we can do right now that would make a difference. Recently, when we looked at recruitment and retention, we got to understand that it's one of the toughest in Alaska. I think about it. You alone in a community providing public safety and being there without support, without the ability to call for immediate backup, and that's a problem. Our state troopers don't necessarily go into those situations like that by themselves. Mm-hmm. Our VPSO officers are limited in what they can do too, but they don't even have necessarily all the tools that they can use right now to go into these homes. And we have several of these situations that happen routinely. What I get really concerned with under recruitment and retention, we've been asking for increased wages. We've been asking for sign-in bonuses and even retention bonuses. Now, when I look at that, that's a real thing for me, because when I look at doctors, and we hire doctors, and doctors are really hard to bring to Alaska right now, and there's only certain ways that we can attract them. And one of those ways is money. You pay them well, they like their sign-on bonuses, and you're also able to retain them over a period of time. When we invest into a VPSO officers, that's a lot of money coming from state funds to invest in that officer to make sure that they're going to be a viable candidate and they can do their work appropriately and efficiently. That money gets, if they leave us and leave the law enforcement system altogether, that's money we lost. It'd be more beneficial if we can maintain it and retain it. And so let's do what we can to retain these officers and make sure that they're given the proper support. But I also want to share this one thought. The VPSO program is successful. And I want to share this with you, is that when there is a presence, that changes what's happening within the community. It was alluded to, if there wasn't a police, public, law enforcement here in Juneau, what'd it be like?
Yeah.
And that's the same. And then there are lots of places in rural Alaska, it's like lawless land right now. And that's not okay, because our women and children are being hurt. And I have to deal with that every year. I got a meeting coming up in 2 weeks. I'm going to be hearing it again from our youth talking about when are we going to do something different. And we're trying to get to something different right now. And I'm glad that we have that partnership going on within the GTAC meeting or the Governor's Tribal Advisory Council, along with the commissioners, to try to create a plan moving forward. But we need to have some flexibility. We need to have some authority within that program to run it effectively and efficiently. And at times, the way it's been currently managed, it's been managed to the point where we don't have any authority to design a program that is going to be beneficial and successful. And what we want to do is have that ability. Now, through all of our other grants, we've been given the authority to do this. And when we have done it, we've put together some pretty good programs out there that are recognized not only throughout the state of Alaska, but nationally and internationally as well. We're constantly being asked, how are you guys doing this? This makes a lot of sense. We want to bring that same knowledge base into a program that we can be with the flexibility of being able to design a program to meet the needs of our communities and our individual areas is vital to the success of this program. Now, if we can't, and when we try to say one shoe fits all, it just don't work, because the struggles that they deal with in Southeast or Southern in Kodiak is not the same as Interior. Right. And we all know this, and there's a difference. And so we need to be able to design that program a little bit more.
So, Victor, if I could ask you, I noticed that you have here allowing rotating shifts from hub communities.
Right.
That's one. Are these mostly regulatory, and is that something you've been working with this committee that the governor put together?
One more time, please, Mr. Chairman.
So it looks like they're regulatory issues.
Right.
I don't know that there's a statutory issue that is a barrier. Is that something that you've worked with the commissioner on and are continuing to work on?
That's what we're currently looking at right now. Okay. In our subcommittee that we put together. We're looking at statute, regulatory, and just also administration management. And so one of the things we're seeing are some regulatory concerns, But a lot of the concerns that we're seeing are just within the grant itself. And so I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit if we clean up the grant that we're going to be able to fix up a lot of this. What it does is detail the micromanagement or the management of administration without creating the flexibility. It takes away our ability.
So part of my purpose of having you here was to let you go ahead and let us in on a conversation that you've been having and then look at solutions. Certainly the dollar bills, the cost of actually supplying is a real conundrum for all of us. We're trying to figure out where do we put our best dollar for the greatest good we can get out of it, because we just don't have that many right now. And it looks to me like you're doing the same thing, and we want to make sure we're not putting any more pressure on there than we're not already ourselves feeling within our own police, because that this is one of the places where the people are the same. Even though the tribal groups have a little different look at the world, they're still Alaskans, and we're trying to figure out how do we make sure that the best benefit gets there as best we know how. I think that's one of the reasons I'm so appreciative of the work that you guys are just every day trying to figure out. But I wanted to hear a little bit of what you were saying with our own government, and I think it's important for us to hear.
So when I talk about running a successful program, I also talk about sustaining a program. And one of the things that we have proved over the years is that we can do a lot with very little. And as we look at the part of the solutions that we have and have been working with on the House side, we're also looking at how do we maximize the dollars that we already have. Currently, what's going on is DPS is giving money back because it's not being spent. I'm saying that if we had an opportunity to administrate this program the way we see fit, not that we want to spend the money foolishly, but we want to spend the money wisely and be able to create opportunities that we need to have. A police officer or a BPSO officer should have the gear that they need. They should have the communication equipment they need. They should have the tools that they need to get from point A to B. They should have the support of other officers. They should be able to travel out to communities when they can. And we should be able to maximize other benefits within this area, within the dollars you can come in. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'm not asking for new money. I'm asking us to maximize the money that we're currently giving to the state DPS. The House has supported making sure that $500K is being used for BPSO travel. One of our travel lines in the BPSO program is very limited on our travel budget, and so that makes it difficult for us to use our rovers, or if we need to get some extra coverage over to another area, how do we do that? Just having that flexibility and that money within our program and the ability to move money like we would in normal contracts, then that would give us a lot of flexibility to send officers where we needed them to go without having to be asking each and every time.
So
to
Victor,
do this.
Just out of curiosity, does that require a rewriting of contracts or regulatory scheme?
Every time that you are getting ready to go outside of a line item right now, we have to make an additional request. And we can give you a list of additional requests that we've had sent out that takes a lot of administrative time, when we should be able to have the flexibility working that grant and just moving that dollars. Now, within most contracts, when you're running state programs, you have the flexibility of moving a certain amount of money from one line item to the next. With this one, we're having to go and ask each and every time, and that makes it really burdensome. So if I have, if I have some dollars left over in personnel, which if you have vacancies, you would, why not take some of that and put it into travel, and how do you take some of that and put it into maybe overtime, because we're even limited on the amount of overtime that we can give each one of our BPSOs officers, which creates other hardships when we're looking at this. Now, this is some of that low-hanging fruit that we think that we can take care of simply by moving forward and cleaning up some of the contract and working with DPS a little bit differently here and asking them to loosen up some of the reins here so that we can be effectively running to their program. Through discussion and partnership, I believe we're kind of on that way, but we need to keep the push on. Also, too, before I turn this over to my partner here, I wanted just to talk about this, is that, you know, I want us to be able to maximize our resources and be able to run a successful program. What we're needing help in looking at is this is a 40-year program. Really, we need to be making sure that this works effectively. What we set out to be worked at one time, and we all know the BPS role program was very effective. Through the changes of time, we've seen more challenges, and right now we're seeing the challenges that our nation's fixing to. And here's the president.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. I think, you know, really I want to reiterate a lot of what I've heard today already, but be succinct in the fact that, you know, we talk about compacting, and for whatever reasons that scares some people. Really, the tribes are very sophisticated. TCC, Tlingit and Haida operate, you know, over, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars already. The accountability would not only still be there, it'd be more stringent. That accountability is very important. It builds the trust and the faith, and it keeps us, you know, beholden to each other, and that the state would want to work with us. And, you know, we do that now with federal funds, and we do it very well. You know, compacting really would just give us the flexibility to design a program that is flexible for all of rural Alaska. You mentioned, you know, that the tribal view is kind of its own, and I want to say I agree. I think it's very holistic. We're looking at the health and the well-being of our whole community, Native and non-Native alike. And, you know, I want to put a picture, if I can, to some of the crisis in our communities, and I'll use my own story. I was a mayor in my community for 13 years, council for 18, and tribal president for 18. We didn't have a VPSO for many of those years, so that kind of rested on me. You know, I joked that my Tlingit name should be Hat Rack because I was fire chief. I was this, as that. Whatever needed to be done, I did it. But that also meant victim.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been held at gunpoint. I've waited the 3 to 4 hours for Alaska State Troopers to respond because we didn't have a VPSO. I've dealt with the opioid and the meth addiction firsthand, very personally, and I try not to get over dramatic about it, but until you've been held at gunpoint by somebody high on meth, you really don't know scared. You really don't know what we face in rural Alaska, because hey, it happens here in Juneau too, but I can guarantee you here there will be a SWAT team, and the village may be nothing but your neighbor. I literally had my neighbor who was a Vietnam-era vet, not era, he was in Vietnam, had a rifle drilled in on the person, my best friend since I'm 3 years old, who was high on meth, ready to take him out. That's what's going on in our communities. I took Commissioner Monaghan to the village of Cake, where we heard just days prior to our visit, the principal of the school trying to figure out who the sharpshooters in town were because there was somebody walking around the village shooting right by the school. This is what we're facing. Our communities don't feel safe. And I think if we had the ability to design our own program, to be flexible, to bring in rovers and backup, the things, like Victor said, we're not asking for new money here. This is money that we're turning back now. If we had if we could compact and design a flexible program that really fits the needs of rural Alaska, we wouldn't have near as many of these stories. I wouldn't be sitting here telling you about the feeling of watching your lifelong friend hold a gun to your head and you don't recognize him because there's a vacancy in his eyes. Wow. That's the reality in our villages. That's the reality in rural Alaska. When mothers and fathers are talking about their 11-year-old daughter being murdered and left in the doorway of a church. When I take a call in my village and my friend's daughter's been murdered and their body's left in a rock quarry for 3 days, that's what's going on right now. I also want to say, and this is just a tangent and I got your ear, if it was a moose, we'd have 3 brown shirt troopers there in an hour. And that's no lie, and that's not an exaggeration. That's what we're dealing with in rural Alaska. I went to, we had a caucus in Anchorage, and the Lieutenant Governor was there, and one of the Attorney Generals, they got eviscerated over the fact that this is the reality. You're an indigenous person. You feel less important than a moose. That's what's going on. And that's, you know, we identify as indigenous and Alaska Native, but we're Alaskans.
Well, that's one of the things I keep maintaining, that it's about Alaskans. And because of the kind of the growth and the growth of us as a society, and the change and growth in federal law, tribal issues, and state law, it's a conundrum we've been trying to figure out. And that is, when does the state, for example, work with you, but when does it relinquish authority, and we end up having two different citizenships, which this is going to be a very difficult thing. And those are things I struggle with, and trying to figure out how do we make this thing work. Because on one hand, I raise my hand to uphold our Constitution, right? And it can't be race-based. And so then I work with tribal groups that quite often, notwithstanding, I know you work with people broadly, but it's definitely tribal-based. And so those are the conundrums. It's a push and pull continually, trying to figure out how do we work with each other. It really comes down to the cooperation, and how do we get the best dollar to the best place, you know. So
if I can, Senator, I'd like to speak to that. You know, it gets thrown or pointed out to me often that it's a race base. It's not. We're a government, and you know, it's not about giving up authority. We can work these out in the agreements, and it can be spelled out very succinctly, and the state does not have to give up authority. It doesn't. And you know what? The federal government and the state government, when they work with us already, don't give up authority. We're doing an OCS compact right now that doesn't give up, the state doesn't give up authority. They're just sharing duties.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to do.
But we've been a long time getting there. And
we
so,
have. Yeah. We have.
And I've been part of the problem and part of the solution all along the way.
And you have. And I've appreciated what you've done for us with tribal courts, and you know, you've been an ally, Senator, and I think if you all just kind of shift your view a little bit, you can see that this isn't an either-or. We can do this collaboratively, and we can do it for the best interest of Alaskans.
So what you and Victor have brought forward is not only some problems, but some honest-to-goodness for real solutions, and I think those are things that we need to ponder. Certainly, as we go through the legislative session, at the end of the day, we're going to put out an annual budget. These are places where we'll probably have some conversations with our own public safety. But I wanted you to have your chance to have the say. We've actually used up the time, but for your benefit, I can tell you, we normally go till 3, and I was going to have another bill up. But that bill, because of Senator Wilkowski, is going to be held over for some amendments. So I wanted to allow for some questions, but Victor, you had a thing, and then I'll open it up for questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to make this quick. Really, we have, when we're looking at it today, we came in with 5 problems with 5 solutions, mm-hmm. and you have them. I can read them for the record, or else I can move through it. But
they'll be posted on.
They'll be posted website. Online.
Yeah.
But we also want to ask for the committee support as we look at some of the what the House is trying to do and add travel dollars, changing the intent language that we can spend the appropriations as designed. I think those are reasonable asks. I mean, for us to give back $1 million when we have public safety needs in rural areas, that's not okay. And so we can be doing a lot better. It may sound beneficial, but it ain't. It's costing us someplace somewhere. And I want to make sure that we maximize and we have a great opportunity. Last thing I'll say here is since our last meeting at GTAC, there has been a shift with our relationship with public safety, and I'm really happy that I'm working with Commissioner Walt Monaghan and also Deputy Commissioner Bill Culver just differently right now. And I'm seeing that change and moving. And so that partnership, I'm hoping that it's going to get strengthened so that we can have positive change. But one of the things I want to make sure that we say here is we need more flexibility in managing these grants. and we need more authority to do that. Allow us to do our job, and we're going to do it successful. And I know that you, when I look at you, Senator, Senator Bishop, when you're micromanaging any operation too tight, it creates controls unnecessary and burdens the job. And I know you all know that. And so what we got to do is open it up here and make sure that we can do our job. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I had Senator Bishop wanted to chime in, and then Senator Wilkowski, if you got anything, this would be the time to chime in.
Okay. So let me go back about an hour ago. I've been writing all these my questions down. So so your uniforms, they're just a one-size-fits-all, right? You have no differential between summer or winter uniforms?
Hey, go ahead, Jody.
You want your
let's, let's get the let's get the VPSO up here, Jody.
Sergeant Jody.
Thank you, gentlemen. Through the chair, Senator Bishop. So in the VPSO program, there is just one type of uniform for every VPSO across the state. It is a winter weight type of uniform, long sleeves. And for the interior, for example, well, both of you, I believe, would know how hot it gets in the interior in the summer. And having to work a search and rescue out in the sun all day for I've worked search and rescues in the sun for 16 hours in a winter weight uniform with a duty vest. And so just things like that. I think VPSO morale is very low, and I think that contributes to our retention rates and our inability to recruit. And so if we were able to have the flexibility to adjust the uniforms, to change the hat, these would be inexpensive but good fixes that would help raise the morale. And just like, you know, I heard DPS and our good colonels do a presentation on AST, you know, and to have happy, satisfied employees is really important. And in the VPSO program, our officers are not happy and satisfied, and just a little fix of uniform changes, I think, would really be beneficial and help us achieve that.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question.
Victor, I don't know if it was you or Richard. There were 37 villages with no law enforcement presently. Who said that? Is that by design? Or
Absolutely not, sir.
All right.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. So currently, because of the recruitment and retention issues, TCC has three certified VPSOs. We have two in the academy, and then myself. So there are currently six of us. Two are rovers based out of Fairbanks, and then one is actually in Nenana, and we're placing two more this coming summer once they complete the academy outside. So we do have so many villages with the unmet need. There's a lot of things that are happening, lawless, crime that's unaccounted for, solutions we have requested is more rovers based out of Fairbanks to travel more, to go out there, because it's, if you saw our table, you know, we have a lack of VPSO housing that makes it difficult to recruit someone to go there on this type of low wage, pay the high living expenses out in our community, and so we're not able to keep people out there or recruit them. So,
okay, thank you.
Continue, Senator.
Your recruitment problems, are you reaching down and talking about what VPSOs do in grade school and middle school?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, we have a number of different things that we have done. VPSOs, every time they go out into village, they're in the schools regularly. I recruit for this position. I think it's really interesting. About 4 years ago, I went with a large group of law enforcement officials on a Yukon River trip. We went with state troopers, FBI, U.S. Marshals, and then VPSOs, and in the school setting, asking how many of you want to become VPSOs, and no one raised their hand. How many want to become state troopers? Lots of kids raised their hand. How many want to become FBI? Lots of kids raised their hand. And I think that, you know, as I talked earlier about the history of the program, you saw a lot of the way the officers were treated, and as far as, like, the unfunded mandates, the lack of support, the you know, the officers not feeling supported or appreciated or respected because of, you know, some questioning authority, you know, not being armed, these kind of things. I think the general public, it's hard to recruit for a position like this.
Okay. Okay, then, Mr. Chairman, this is my last question and a little editorial comment.
Just for the records, lady, it's been Jody Potts, Sergeant Jody Potts has been answering those.
So, Victor, you've got a ballpark. You know what you probably need to spend for overtime. You've got that backup somewhere, and as well for the cost of travel. And if you didn't have to send $1 million back and you could use that, you'd probably be okay.
Right now, thank you, and through the chair, if I can. Thank you. When I look at overtime, travel budget, we have those numbers. And what we want to be able to have the ability to do is when we write our contract, that contract gets funded completely, nothing gets withheld, mm-hmm. all the money comes over to us, and we have the ability to move that between lines just like we would any other contract to be able to adjust. Now, one of the strengths of that method is that we can adjust that budget to make it work. And so, but the simple answer to it, yes, we do, and we know those costs, and we put that in our proposal each and every time, each and every fiscal year.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And for Jody, I have a question, unless you have one, Senator Wilkowski. Go ahead. You go first.
Yeah, thank you. Two questions. Number one, do you have any data on crime rates in villages with and without VPSOs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, we do. We have recorded criminal data for years back and periods where we have no VPSO, periods where we do. And then when things typically tend to settle down, the trend that we see is where there is not a law enforcement officer, there's definitely a lack of reporting crime because they may have they realize in a remote village that's maybe one or two mountain ranges away from the nearest trooper post that there's going to be a delay in response time. And so we have a lack of reporting. But once we have a VPSO in the village, I can talk about one village in particular where we didn't have a VPSO for a large number of years. And then once, and there was only like, I think probably a few, maybe less than a half a dozen crimes reported throughout the year. But once I put a VPSO in that community, I mean, the crime numbers went up significantly, but specifically because they had someone to report to, someone that they trusted. And now crime was being responded to, there is accountability, and then what you typically see is crime will begin to reduce once that VPSO has been there for some time.
Senator.
I'm curious, from the testimony I heard, it sounds to me like crime is increasing in the villages. Is that what you're seeing? And if so, what do you attribute the root cause? Why are we seeing an increase in crime?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski.
Got it right.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I apologize. So I would say that it's a number of issues. I think that as we look at villages that have not had an officer, people who tend to commit crimes, and it's typically just a small group of people or a few individuals, it being unaccounted for, it just creates this cycle of violence that perpetuates if no one's ever being held accountable for it. We also have drugs that are now coming into our village that we have never seen in our history in the last less than 10 years, maybe 5 years. And that's having a huge impact on not just the number of violent incidents, but the level of violence. So just in my career since 2009, I have seen polysubstance use and just unpredictable violent behavior that has a lot of times went from maybe a minor assault that turned into felony charges by the time we were done with the whole situation. So I would say that the number of things, lack of law enforcement, and then also the drugs that are now entering our communities.
If I can add, Mr. Chairman, you know, you talk about some of these crimes and the increase. I think the concern that I have is the number of unreported that's the concern right now. But what we do is that we hear what's happening on the ground. That's not going into an official record. And so that's very concerning, just the number of people who are not reporting very serious crimes against people.
So if you live in a small town and it doesn't have some accountability, whether it's a VPSO, people will live in fear and they won't say anything. And then somebody will go out to defend themselves, and then you have a real problem. And that just happens as a matter of course, just from my own experience living in the interior. The unfunded mandate question, I was going to get back to Jody a little bit. I see a couple of the solutions were housing and whatnot. What are some of the unfunded mandates that are continually unsolvable to you right now?
Definitely housing, I think, is a big one. You know, I appreciated earlier, for example, when you talked about how in Alaska we're all Alaskan citizens, you know, and we should all be protected under the law. And I definitely see that these unfunded mandates put on typically Native communities is in contrast to us being all Alaskan citizens. And so communities, you know, there are communities that have state troopers with housing taken care of, with, you know, their office and jail cell and things of that nature. But community has to figure out how they're going to heat their office. And one of the only ways we can recruit people to live in a rural community is by providing housing. We have a number of communities that don't have a secure holding cell. I've had to do it myself of handcuffing people to office furniture in order to secure them until we were able to transport to Fairbanks. In the past, until 4 years ago, equipment was an unfunded mandate. And so officers went without the proper and safe equipment to do this. That was fixed. There are other things here, I think, that need to be fixed as well. You know, the indirect rate was an issue, and I think that there are some regional contractors that still have an unmet need in that area. But those are just some examples.
I surely appreciate that. I thought maybe there was more to it. No, don't get me wrong. I thought there was more to what I saw written on the paper, and you kind of nailed it. So, and I appreciate that. One of the struggles that we're going to have, that we all are going to have, and I'm saying this for the commissioner's benefit as well as yours, and that is we have more needs than we have resource cash to work with. And so we have had to do some kind of tough triage, and that's true in all arenas. But one of the things I do appreciate, and I mean this as sincerely as I can, and I don't even know all the details, but with your effort, it goes into communities with the kind of relationship and care that multiplies the dollars. And so the fact that you're stressed is one of the reasons I wanted to have you here to present number one solutions plus your needs. The commissioner's been good enough to sit through the whole meeting, so and I know these are not new to him, but they're new to us in many ways. They're new to our ears, and I think it's important that we also hear them in this kind of a setting. So I'm grateful for that. And your little sheet here was very well put together, and this is a good document to show how we share across Alaska really a great need. So for every day that you wake up, Sergeant, and look out for the benefit of the people in your under your authority, thank you, and for Clinkett and Haida. If you think Willikowski's hard to say, you should try to say some Clinkett names.
I do every day.
And Victor, for the day-to-day work that you look out for both the interior villages and the people that are kind of floating through there on a pretty regular basis, because we have a pretty dynamic population. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm going to close this meeting down. I didn't anticipate having the commissioner come forward at this point. I wanted you to be able to have the floor, but I think it's generated some questions that we will go to public safety with, and unless there's another question, I think
comment.
One more comment, Senator
Bishop. For Mr. Peterson, Commissioner Folger.
Commissioner Folger.
just for your, you remember the last commissioner, so you probably can't tell me who the commissioner of labor was in 2008 either, but no.
He's helped me like that many times.
Thank you, and Ganuk Trishawa to all of you for your work.
All right. Thank you very much, and I appreciate you coming before this committee. I think what you did was brought to light the very discussion that we should all be involved in and deeply. So thank you very much.
And thank you, Senator.
All right.
And Senators.
With that, we're adjourned.